week, you may have heard of them. So, also, I am one of the co-founders of GenSpace. Sorry, that's my living room. So, moving right along. All right, why is New Media important? Why are they our friends? Why are they someone we should deal with? Very quickly, the media is our outlet to the public world. Now, obviously, you have the internet, which is your way of sending out messages, but they have a much wider audience. So either they reflect public opinion or they create public opinion. So that's pretty obvious, isn't it? Okay. The thing is, you could want the media to present your way of your view of the world. They're not going to. The journalist has his own point of view. The editor has their own point of view. You can try to control it as much as you want. You can do a number of things which we'll discuss, but ultimately, the journalist is his own being and can make his decisions about what it is you do. That's actually a good thing, right? If you were actually a corrupt politician and the media were in your hands, that would be bad for the rest of us. So let them do their job. The other thing that I've discovered as part of GenSpace is you can get a lot of attention. It's still not clear for a group like ours, the community lab or the DIY movement, how exactly that gets monetized. How you turn that into money for your organization to continue running. So let's move right along. What is the journalist looking for? The journalist himself needs to be able to tell a story. He needs to basically say, here's something that's spectacular. So this is going to change, destroy, improve everything, right? That's your perfect story as a journalist. When he looks at you and he looks at your work, how is your work going to change, improve, destroy everything, right? They're being an extreme. You know that in your lab you're doing something certainly non-extreme, but that's the story that's going to sell. And the reason is, well, you want people to look at your article. So the more impressive whatever it is you're writing about is, the more eyes you're going to get on that piece. And then, of course, the thing that's really interesting that we've found is because we're amateurs, or because we're this new movement, amateurs isn't the right word, is it? No. Because we're this new movement, everything we do is under scrutiny, which is a good thing, because it means anything that we do that's positive almost automatically gets coverage. So any small accomplishment, big to us, maybe small to the science world, is newsworthy. And we've seen that with the OpenPCR, we've seen that with the gel boxes, we've seen that with the Dremelfuge. These are all wonderful technologies, but the thing that brings them to us, the thing that brings the journalists to us, is the fact that we're not scientists, that we're doing science in an unconventional setting. So, that said, education is nice, showing them that we're teaching students and people and lay people and adults all about the science is one thing, but if you make something, that's where the journalists get really excited. It doesn't have to be the most spectacular thing, it just has to be something new. So we've been following the news, well, since we've started, we've basically been watching, or I've been watching the news cycle around us. And essentially, it's been a pendulum. At first, you get something scary sounding in the closets. Biohackers discover Frankenstein and biotech in the basement and how it's a total sham in that one. I think that's what that says. The geneticists in the garage are they destroying everything. That's sort of where we started. You'll see, though, that it swung back more recently when our lab opened up and when BioCurious opened up. I sort of love that bottom headline, forget about it, broke into bioscience, to big bioscience, forget about it. But you see that suddenly, GenSpace or really community biotech is in, of all places, fashion and style, which is just bizarre, right? Suddenly it's chic to be geek. You got Wired excited about it. That other one is Science Magazine. And the Forget About It one, I think, was Discover. So, excitement. And then more recently, we've had this, you know, the bird flu issue. And although it had nothing to do with us, it came to us in force. So you have this article about DIYers making mucovirus, and, you know, is it possible that DIY biology might make the mockingjay, which I didn't know what it was until I read the article. And over there, you know, there's Ellen and Oliver on PBS, or being interviewed for PBS, which turned out to be a sequence about, what was it about? It was about biohacking, but the biohacking they were talking about was someone going into, hacking into someone, into software that was related to people's pacemakers, and somehow turning on people's pacemakers. Somehow that migrated to, oh, well, these guys are working with biology too, so that's dangerous as well. It did not make any sense. However, we were at the butt end of that, and all the ways that the company are doing it. All right, so where do we go? So you get a phone call from, well, before you even get a phone call from the journalist, long before you get the phone call from the journalist, there's a couple of things you need to have ready and in mind. The first is that you should have someone in your lab, actually before you have someone at your lab who can be a spokesperson, you should have a website up that talks about exactly what you do. That's sort of your outlet to the world. It explains your safety protocols. It should explain basically who you are. That's the first thing the journalist is going to look at. That's how he's going to find you. Or even if he finds you through word of mouth, that's his next step. So, all right, you have your website. You have someone who you've designated, or a couple of people who can act as a spokesperson, who sort of gets what your lab project is about. All right, the next thing you need to know is, or next thing that they need to do, to know their safety protocols. You need to have that down, because every journalist, doesn't matter where they're coming from, doesn't matter what publication, doesn't matter whether it's a science publication, a radio show, television, this is sort of the question in everyone's mind, and it has to be asked, which is, what are your safety? What do you do about safety? And you need to know that down pat. And if they don't ask you, bring it up anyway. All right. So, be able to explain who can work in your space, what they can do. Have that down pat. I don't need to explain that when we talked about that a bunch. This is something that GenSpace has. Does BioCurious have a biosafety board? I highly recommend it. If you have a local university member, and you know there are professors in every university that are really gonna know about what we're doing, if you have someone who's available to you, definitely, definitely pull those people together, because that's something you can say, hey, MIT's on our side. We vet everything through them. All right, I'm gonna move on through quickly. Build a relationship with local law enforcement, or and you should bring up the fact that you're here. These are all things that legitimate you. Okay, before the interview, since I'm running out of time very quickly, know who's interviewing you. Who is the person, who are they writing for, what section is it, who's the editor. The more you know about the publication, the more you know the types of questions they're going to ask you, and the better prepared you'll be for the interview. You want to prepare for the interview. So moving right along, you know, if you don't have any of those answers, ask the journalist, what's the article about? You know, you can do that. It's not a big problem. And you know, mostly they'll be honest about it. Okay. Next thing, know the media climate. So if, you know, all this bird flu is in the news, well, guess what? If a journalist is contacting you, it's not going to be an innocuous innocuous article about the wonderful things you're doing. It's going to be about bird flu. And so know that. Know what's going on around you. Next thing, it's okay. Sometimes it's okay to decline an interview. I'll give you an example very quickly. If you live in San Francisco and you're being, and someone in, I don't know, New Zealand wants to do an interview with you, it's not going to help you, probably, that some local newspaper in New Zealand is going to publish an article about you. If you don't have the time or you don't feel like doing it, fine, don't do it. If you think the article is going to be political or aggressive, say no. But I would also recommend you to refer them to someone else. So if there's, I don't know, a New Zealand biohack group, refer them to them. Or if there's another person on the other side of the country, or I don't know, someone who represents the larger movement in your mind, go ahead and refer them to them. And then, you know, even if you do want to do the interview, refer them to someone else anyway. There's only a certain number of interviews that a journalist is going to do before they start writing the article. So if you stack the deck, if you load it with buddies, then basically you're going to get a possible article. If you say, if you do your interview with me, that's it, they're going to go back online, go back through their contact list, and start looking for someone else to interview, and you lose control of that article. Alright, now immediately before the, what was that last one? Oh, and the last thing, of course, is prepare for the interview. Even if you do some talking points, that'll help you along a lot. It sounds weird because, you know, they're just interviewing you about your life. But actually, if you know what, if you write down what it is exactly you want to say, it'll go more smoothly. And also, you won't be up for surprises. During the interview, be polite. Be excited about what you're doing. I think that actually that excitement is really what will capture the journalist, just like any audience. If you're really excited about what you're doing, they're going to be excited about it too. Just kidding. The other thing is it's just common courtesy. If the journalist is coming to your lab or to your project, whatever it is, invite everyone else to be there as well. It shows that a real community spirit, and it's nice for the other people who get to showcase the things they're doing. The other thing that I wanted to say is no one speaks for DIY bio, which is actually a liberating thing, right? Basically, if someone says, well, what does DIY bio mean, or what is that other lab on the other side of the world doing, or what do you think about that? You know what, the best thing that you could possibly say is, I don't represent that lab, I know what we do at our lab, and leave it at that. And really it is liberating, because the questions that you'll get, if they do think that you represent the entire movement, will take a whole other tenor and will force you to basically a corner that you won't be able to get out of. So that's actually very liberating. If you don't know something, admit it. Certainly don't lie. if you lie or you exaggerate the truth, eventually it'll get out. Or if it doesn't get out, they'll get you the next time. And it'll blow your credibility, it'll blow everyone else's credibility. Refer them to your partners again. Referring them is probably the most important part of this lecture. Refer them to anyone you work with. And of course, they're going to want to talk to someone on biosecurity. Refer them to your guys in biosecurity. There are plenty of people out in the world who say DIY bio is dangerous and going to wreck the world. There are plenty of people who actually think it's a positive thing and have worked with us and know what's going on. You want them to interview those people. After the interview, I know I'm running a little bit over, but I'm almost done. After the interview, thank the journalist for coming. Thank you for your interest. When it's published, thank you for your interest. That's just common courtesy. A lot of us forget to do it, but it actually means a lot to the journalist. And if there's some kind of cue that you're in, it knocks you up a couple of points. Okay, post-interview, you might just get a number of requests flooding in your inbox. If you're interviewed by the New York Times or the Washington Post or, you know, a big magazine, there's chances are people are reading it and are getting excited and want to contact you. What I would say is be prepared for that eventuality. Either have a number of people manning your inbox. The other thing I would say is, you know, there might be some people who actually want to help out. And also, you know, there's a chance that it'll go into a popular publication, you know, it'll fizzle. And that's fine. That's fine. You know, that publication that goes on your website, that gives you more credibility. That's something that you can reference when you have another opportunity or another journalist comes your way. Again, you know, you have your website. If the article is positive and you like it, go ahead and put it up on the website. You're doing the journalist a favor. He'll remember that. You're pushing, you know, you're getting readers reading his article. And also, you know, it just boosts, again, your credibility. Even if it's not right, even if the article gets it wrong, if you could put it up on your blog, go ahead, put it up on your blog, and then criticize it. You know, you have a mouthpiece, too. I think people forget that. The other thing you can do is, all right, so he gets it wrong. You tell the journalist. It's just something you should do. Contact the editor, write a letter to the editor. You know, chances are, these are monthly publications, whatever they are, they're radio or television. They're really not going to do anything about it. But again, you do have a voice. And it's okay if nothing happens. Because there's so much media out there, a lot of these articles kind of just join the list of the many other articles. And that's okay. You can still say, hey, we were in PBS News, and leave it at that. You know, so what if we were in 32? All right. And the last bit, which I'm not really going to go into, is courting the media. So now you've invented something really cool. You want people to find out about it. Well, you've been interviewed by all these other journalists beforehand. Now's your chance to tap them. You were polite. You were courteous. You did all these wonderful things with them. They wrote a positive article for you before. Even if they didn't write a positive article about you before, go to them and say, hey, we did this. That personal relationship will go a long way. If you want, write press releases. That's a whole other talk. But the other thing that is really great is building work, you know, basically building your own sort of word of mouth. How shall I say, publicity. Basically tell all your friends, tell everyone you know. Because a journalist really, you know, at heart is sort of a digger. They're scrounging around looking for an article that no one else has written. If they feel like they've discovered you or discovered it, it's going to feel a whole lot better for them, and it's going to reflect that article. And I will leave you with that. That's my homage to the newsies over there. Feel free to contact me. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dan. That talk was brilliant. I don't have to go to a lot of stuff that was in my talk. I'm Rachel Turner. I'm from Man Lab. We're based in Manchester. It stands for Manchester Digital Laboratory. And we run DIY Bio Manchester, as you know from yesterday. My background and the reason that I've been invited to talk here is because I have about 15 years' experience as a television producer and journalist. I worked at the BBC for about 10 years. Here's one of the programmes that I produced and directed. It's a science theme that's about force-feeding women in Mauritania. And more recently, I've been working at Al Jazeera English in Qatar. I worked on a few science-based documentary programmes in my time. Apart from the force-feeding one, there was a programme called Munchausen Syndrome by Proxy, dog breeding. I recently was nominated for a Monte Carlo TV award last year, so for the best documentary. So my experience is predominantly in broadcast media, but I've worked on local news, I've worked on network news, I've worked on international well when I started my career. And I also know lots of journalists as well in the print media, so I kind of hope to cover all bases. So that's us. And not only covered it, this is what Nathaniel asked me to cover today. So hopefully, if we don't get all of these done, then you can ask me questions in a bit.
That's a direct quote.
That's a direct quote. So on to the media. I mean, this is it's another slide we had yesterday. It was David Shuffman from the BBC, and I'm going to be talking about him in a bit. Essentially, we've had a lot of coverage in the UK because we are, sorry, London tax base, I think we're the biggest in the UK. And a lot of people kind of come to us because we have quite a good online presence. One thing that I haven't mentioned in my speech, but I've just remember now, we need to talk about social media as well. We have a very active Twitter stream. We have a very active website as well, so we kind of publish our own news on there. We have blogs, we have people writing their own blogs, we tweet about it. We have 5,000 people on our Twitter stream. So we're kind of constantly churning out stories on there. I've got a lot of mentions from the public and stuff, so we have kind of discussions on there, message boards and things like that. So, I'm a journalist, so I don't see any stories being negative story particularly, although I'm going to go and talk about two stories that we had in the press, one on radio and one on television, that have been, I think some of you probably might have seen these as well, it could have been construed as negative, but I think that's just kind of the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. So I'll start with Radio 4 just because it was the first one that came to us, and 504 is the flagship current affairs programme for BBC Radio, and it's available online as well, so you can see it around the world. So this is the approach that we got from 504. I actually used to work on 504, this is kind of like 6 years, 7 years after I left. So, if you're interested in the boat, isn't it lovely, VCR machines, exclamation point. But this is what we read. Blue virus researchers, as you were saying. And we knew that it wasn't, we were going to be portrayed as being extreme, because we knew 504 comes from a extreme point of view. We knew that we're the only, apart from London, we're the only group that can kind of say these things. So regardless of the fact that we were not necessarily the right people, we were going to be their people anyway. And so it was. So this is, we did the interviews and stuff, and so this is it in the programme guide on the BBC website. So, very concerned. The FBI is a unit to monitor, so there you are. Biological threats. So it's all in the same sentence. So I'm going to play the audio from this, but I've taken the transcript from online as well. So, like all good journalists, I'm rubbish at using computers. So,
from this one,
please, I think it should be.
Yeah,
it's
lighter.
There you go.
Yeah.
Extracting your own DNA. Sweet. 504 enters one of the rooms, which is perfectly doable, and you can do it in the kitchen.
So that
sounds
horrible.
It's a lot like cooking. What if this branch of knowledge were to fall into the wrong hands? In the event of accidents or an attack,
sorry about this.
It's
playing everyone. Jerry Norton, You'll hear the answer from one of our members, kind of say, yeah, that's great. And then you will also hear somebody talking about how basically we're going to kill everybody. So here it is.
Within the laboratory, not transferred outside.
This week, 504 enters one of Britain's most dangerous laboratories, where lethal pathogens are investigated and genetically modified. If any of them got out, it could trigger an epidemic.
We are very, very careful. We know what the consequences of any sort of organism escaping from here is.
Internationally, scientists are raising urgent questions over experiments producing mutant strains of deadly viruses. But it's not only formal laboratories that carry out biological experiments. We report on the growing number of amateur enthusiasts who see microbiology as an innocent hobby, like high-tech home brew.
How far can you go in replicating what people do in sophisticated laboratories?
Very far, if you understand the principles. Extracting your own DNA and then spreading it out so that you can have it analysed is perfectly doable, and you can do it in the kitchen. I mean, truth is, it's a lot like cooking.
What if this branch of knowledge were to fall into the wrong hands? In the event of accidents or an attack, is Britain protected?
I don't think that we are at all well prepared for a major biological attack. If we have the sort of disaster which could follow, and the government of the day was shown to be ill-prepared, I think the wrath of God would fall both on individual ministers and government as a whole, because the public would say, why haven't you dealt with this?
So no understatement there at all. I had another one lined up, but I don't want to go and press this thing anymore. We've got another scientist is when they come to introduce MATLAB, and we've got a scientist beforehand saying, they're talking about synthetic biology, which we don't do at MATLAB currently, but it doesn't seem to require any particular previous skills in biology. You don't have to know what things look like or know how biology functions. You have to know a little bit more about circuitry and about electronics. The need for new things to kill us, new microbes to do damage is questionable. They've managed to rebuild polio, smallpox. They can construct viruses that we thought we were getting rid of, at least thought we were safe and stored away, that can now be done by scientists in a lab or can be done by kids in the garage. Cut to actuality at class. Welcome to MATLAB. And that's ASAP. A bit of judicious editing there. Now, can we go back to the... No, back to my... there we are. That was the one that I was just reading out. And then I have to take another example. This time we had this approach from the BBC. This was the science editor, his assistant, David Shuckman is responsible for everything 10 o'clock news, 6 o'clock news, lunchtime news, anything on Today programme, anything on the radio, anything internationally, News 24, BBC World. So it was a big deal. So we began preparing a feature about synthetic biology and the role of DIY bio. So Acer from MATLAB wrote back and said, and this is the quote, we're not involved in any synbio work. So they turned up, and just beforehand, I did do my digging about Shuckman so that we knew what we were getting in for, and here's some of David Shuckman's previous work. We knew it was going to be, we knew what the thrust was going to be. And I'm going to play a little bit from the news. And again, you can just kind of see how, just how these things kind of play out. I mean, and also look at the massive microbe in the background, whatever the hell it's meant to be, because we don't know. It was starting in a second.
Of the Second World War. I thought it was going to be a pretty dodgy new contract, you know.
Here we go.
Technology, as we reported last night, involved making artificial genes for a
relatively new field of synthetic biology is potentially dangerous and must be stopped. Technology, as we reported last night, involves making artificial genes for a range of applications from fuels to medicines. The campaign has won the tighter controls are needed at a time when the cost of experimenting becomes cheaper. Our science editor, Jamie Chuckler, has a story.
In a back street in Manchester, a group has gathered to do something unimaginable even a few years ago.
It's a laser cut thing.
Look, cool. These are amateur biologists, and they're putting together a machine that makes copies of DNA, a device for playing with the codes for life, a step towards ordinary people controlling nature.
This is all home platform, which is a DIY kind of for the normal person, so it's kind of garage science. So that's what's different about it. So it's people coming together that would be tinkering in their own houses.
Which is very curious. This is the kind of stuff that you carry life with, so.
The idea is to delve deep into cells to manipulate their DNA, and even go a step beyond that to design new artificial DNA. That's attracting huge interest, and the technology is now easy to get hold of.
What's happening is that highly sophisticated scientific equipment, which until recently only institutions could afford, is now tumbling in price. So anyone working on their own can pick it up, opt into it. Here's a DNA synthesizer for well under £1,000. It's a machine that allows you to make artificial genes.
For amateurs, how did you...
So you get the gist. So obviously, I know this was a bit silly. So we then discovered a few weeks later, and rather than me talk about it, This is a kind of online response on YouTube that we found. And let me just kind of pull it up and find it. Okay. So this is an online response we found. We've never met this guy. He's never come to any of our meetings. It's got kind of like 5,000 views on YouTube. And kind of in the aftermath of that report, what was interesting was that there was kind of like 100 comments on the BBC webpage basically saying the report was ridiculous, and we had kind of like lots of messages on our web board. What about that? We didn't have to kind of really say anything because it was pretty obvious that it was. And this is kind of, it's quite funny and kind of reflects.
My name is my friend, sorry. I'm kind of new to Manchester and I'm back there on the weekend, so I thought I'd show around the city and then at the same time show you around the city. So,
be represented in a simple manner. I mean, literally, you know, your sound bites. So thinking 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and that's your lot. And you know, you can't kind of go into a long explanation or anything. If you can keep it into a sentence, that's it, and that's as much as you're going to have. And also, if it's a recorded interview, there's nothing to stop you from repeating your answers just again and again and again to get your message across. And this has happened a couple of times actually when Asa from Mad Lab has done it, and that's kind of the media training I've given him. Actually, it turns out that you know he just generally doesn't appear in the interviews because he's holding the line and kind of repeating about safety and all this kind of stuff. And if they want to get the crazy person who's going to go and talk about blowing things up, then they have to go kind of elsewhere. Say yes and be helpful. We always say yes. I take your point, Jen's face, about you know, declining an interview, and that's true. If you're really busy or you just can't be bothered, that's absolutely fine. But you know, generally, we get requests which are from UK, which are domestic, and so we say yes. And also, you know, journalists talk to each other as well. So you know, we had the final four, which led to the BBC one, it was on BBC, the local media knows about us, and so it kind of all trickles through. And we could have made a complaint about the kind of judicious editing of the final four, but the reason that we didn't, I mean, actually I was involved personally in the biggest Ofcom complaint that the BBC ever had for my Penny B. Dogs programme, long story. But I mean, I knew that I had a case against them, but you just kind of think, well, what's the point? And also, they'll come back to us next time. They're based in Manchester, or Salford now, we're based in Manchester. So you know, you keep that relationship open. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day. And lastly, relax and talk to them normally, or you'll look weird. These are the don'ts. We've had this one before, a couple of members, when we told them, you know, if you want to kind of talk to people, and it's one of my questions in advance, and you know, no good journalist is ever going to give you questions beforehand unless you're a dictator of an African country and you've never given an interview before. But if you're not, then you know, you have to just prepare, and then that's what you should be expected to do. And the reason that they do this is not to catch you out so much as the fact that anybody who's prepared an interview is just going to be really boring, and it's not going to look good on screen or in print. They're not a different journalist, not a different species as well. But generally, they probably tend to get things wrong because they're working to a deadline on 10 different things, or they don't really understand it, or they've got other things on, basically. So it's not necessarily you, the way you've come across to them. And don't be disappointed in what you say. This isn't faithfully represented on screen, because it's not going to be, you know, you've got these little sound bites, so that's all you're going to be playing with, really. And they'll probably take the most ridiculous one that you said as well. But if you know that, then it won't be an issue. And that's not always the case, actually. I'm joking, because if you have people who are kind of on your side, you've worked a relationship with journalists, then they'll want to help you, and then they want to you know, see that you do well as well. And don't expect nuance. Again, it's the same point. Unless you're doing a massive, massive interview, you're not going to get your finer points across, so keep it simple. And just kind of to conclude about kind of positive things, and I'll keep this short. What we do a lot of is like kind of using the local media as our advocates. So they're quite easy to manipulate. Because they will take stories, because they're looking, they've got daily deadlines, they've probably got loads of stuff about domestic abuse and cats going missing, and they want something more interesting in that. So if you can give them a good story, and frequently give them good stories, they're going to give you coverage. And they're not going to have enough time again, so you can kind of dictate the message. This is us kind of talking to Manchester Evening News about coming here. And,
You see it.
Not strictly true. you know, it's an example of what we do. And actually, most of you news are quite good. They're local media. They kind of, you know, bless them, they kind of get things wrong all the time. But what's good is that they're linked into local media organisations. They're always going to be owned by bigger organisations. It's always bigger up the chain. So if you've got a good story, everybody will be checking the stories in their newsrooms. Local media does it, like BBC News does it. I used to work at local news. And so if they pick up your story at local level, it can go national. So not this one, but another one we had on the same week about the transit of Venus went from this paper to the Daily Mail, which is the most read website in the world, and obviously it's a bit of a dubious honour being in the Daily Mail, if you know it. But you can kind of see kind of how the kind of cannibalism in journalism works. So if you kind of hug kind of local people really, really close to you, then you can kind of really control your message, basically, in the wider press. And that's it. Thanks very much.
Lastly, we have Sasha.
Got the money to build a lab, and built this in my office here together with these friends who joined the idea. And not only that, I got a possibility to write this up, but we also got an award for doing a 60-minute documentary, so which was a completely new thing for me because I'm a print journalist, I'm a TV journalist. So, but one of our team, Alexander, he is a TV journalist, and he said, okay, we should try that. And so we started the whole project. We not only started experiments like this sushi stuff, just checking which species you have in your meal, and that was one of the first experiments, and then we did some more stuff. But, before we did that, we talked with a lot of people from the from the DIY and bio scene, so you will recognize most of them here. And left in the right corner is Rüdiger. So we did, I think, the first German biohack in his home. So I was in a double role in at that point. So I'm trying to report about that scene, but on the other hand, I've been quite enthusiastic about doing it by myself and learning how to do it in a home setting and so on. So, of course, that was a very unusual approach for science journalists to write about a thing where you are involved like that. I think probably the Frankfurt Allgemeine, which is kind of the Times of Germany, they decided to make it a very big story. So we got coverage for over about four pages in the science section. The whole science section was for us, more or less. So it was a 7,000 word story. That's absolutely unusual for newspapers. And we submitted the article, and they found it great and so on. And then the circumstances were a little bit difficult, because at that time, a few weeks before that, the flu stuff came out. So they took our story and combined it with reporting about the H5N1 experiments. So what the illustrators made out of that was that. So they had a story of a picture story kind of on top of our article, and it was looking up here. So here you can see Frankenstein on the left, and so we have no influence on that illustration, okay? So I just want to explain to you a little bit how this process is going. So I'm a freelancer, a complete freelancer, so I have to send my article in there, and then the editing begins, okay? So and this is a fight that you always have with editors, not only about minor details of scientific stuff, also, but sometimes they completely change the tone of your article. And you always need to make compromises, because you want to continue writing for them. So you always have to deal with this problem. So, and of course, you can't do anything about that. That's also in the responsibility of the freelancer or the journalist who's doing the article or the TV program. So, but we are in a situation that we interview you, we learn about all this stuff, and then we need, then we get in contact more or less with the rest of the society who has no idea, and the first of the society is the editor. So he has a blank view of do-it-yourself biology, because he did no research. He didn't go and ask you. He is the guy on the street, kind of, and that's his role. So he comes in with all these ideas about, oh, they are building risky stuff in their labs and so on. So now that I'm in the situation to talk with society, so to say, and change his view within an hour or so sometimes, or even via email, because some of these guys have so much to work that they just reported that, everything of the editing just goes via email. So this is the situation where we decided, okay, we can't really do this with the illustrations. We talked with them and so on, but it was 2 days before publication. So the newspaper was in the situation, we can't do another illustration, so we can't postpone this because everything was planned, the whole science section was separated for us, so they put it into the newspaper like that. So we had big arguments about that, but that was the way it goes. And it's so it's always a compromise how you are publishing stuff. I don't want to apologize for how this is working, but this is how journalism, how the rules of journalism are. So I'm, and we are not in a position to change these rules, okay? So sometimes. So of course it's different if there is someone who is really doing research and talking with you and takes his time compared to someone who has no science background and who has no idea of what, even if you explain to him, he's going home and still has no idea of what you are really doing. So there are differences. So, and this might be also a hint for you to choose your journalists, check them up, like Dan said, check them up before. So how much time do you want to spend with someone from the Daily Mail or so, who has really no idea of biology at all? So we had, for example, when we did the documentary, everyone of you saw this already. When we tried to defend our documentary, we had two editors who didn't even know that where the DNA exactly in the cell is. Okay, so and DNA and chromosomes, is this the same and stuff like that? Okay, so that was the level of argumentation that we had. So in a way, that's a good thing because 2 million viewers or more in Germany don't know about all the stuff too. So if they don't understand the movie, these two editors, then the rest of the German public won't understand it too. So in a way it was okay, but you always need to make compromises at that point. So we did the 60-minute documentary, we showed it to you yesterday, and the research that we put into this is much more hours than we earn any money on that. So it's not a very economic thing. So it's kind of, I'm putting my enthusiasm into molecular biology in general into this project. But sometimes you need to be aware that the public discussion is in a very early stage. So even the journalists are making a lot of mistakes right now, and that happens with every technology out there. You have it with nanotechnology or so, but finally it takes time. Journalists learn. So I think that the Frankenstein kind of thing vanishes already a little bit. It pops up sometimes again, but the longer you discuss with the right journalists, then they learn about this and that this is an overestimation and so on. So finally, I have to say this approach that I did it by myself is an unusual thing, but it helped me a lot to find out what you are really doing in the labs and what is possible and where the borders are. And I hope that the reporting comes to a better result and so on in the end. It helps keeping the discussion fresh.
Those that stuck around yesterday, the documentary is very well done, and it covers up a lot of tells a very great story. It involves Steve Kurtz and some of the folks about Curious on the East and West Coast, and even picking up dog poop on the ground to classify, you know, the owners that are helping that. It's quite an adventure. But I know brought up as well. So I definitely want to open it up straight to questions. You have a lot of great advocates here, from here on and moving on, and if you're ever engaged by the media, and I'm sure you can get a lot of good tips if you haven't already. So let's open it up for anyone that has any comments or questions.
Yeah, thanks. I really like Rachel's presentation because she was following also what was the reaction of the public to the news. So I'm curious, in your case, Sasha, have you followed what happened after that article with this like funny comics attached to your article? Because you know, what is actually the reaction of the public to these articles? We see that there are some reactions that are not that naive.
We had a few reactions. I think the most important for us at least was that apparently a professor called the lab that provided us with primers, and he was furious, of course. So why did you give these hackers your primers and so on? And so then we were called by the company, and they talked with us. It was okay. They were not happy about this press. We didn't mention the name of the company, but we said it was located in Berlin, and actually that was enough to make clear that it was this one multi-major company. So, I think the reaction was mixed. Some people are still kind of afraid about that, but our message in the article was they can't achieve bad things. So in biohacking labs, and I think most of the readers got this message at least. And now the problem with the article in the Frankfurt Allgemeine was that it was not online, but now we have this version on another website, Spectrum, where we already gathered some comments from readers, and they are very positive. They even ask about, where can I go to buy the material and stuff like that. So I think.
But is it because they don't have the picture in the online version, or I'm really curious how that picture played, what role it played in the.
Yeah, we didn't get so many reactions to the picture. Some friends told me that they didn't really. That's what the German public expects, actually. So the situation in Germany, as you know, is very hypocritic, I would say, and everything where the word gene comes in, so they expect that. That's a normal thing you can see. So perhaps the article was such a different approach that they, the narrative of this doing it yourself thing was different, and perhaps that was a better.
I just wanted to add a couple of things to, by the way, this was really a great session. I really thought it was really well laid out, like the problems and what we face and what you can do about them, which I think is incredibly valuable. I wish someone had given me this talk 2 years ago. I know you tried to, Dan, you tried to tell us, and I tried to listen to you, but somehow having it laid out as bullet points makes it so much clearer. I would just like to stress some of the points that you made. I think probably the best thing that you can do is to cultivate powerful advocates, relationships with people that can be your advocates, because that's the thing that's going to sway the opinion back after one of these things. Interestingly, in your documentary, Steve Kurtz was saying he had a neighbor that was actually holding up a sign saying, he's not a bioterrorist, he's my neighbor. So that was a very powerful statement for him. And the entire arts community rallied around him. And it turned out to be very powerful because documentaries were made, books were written, artists talked about it, the whole community rose up in outrage. So if you have people that you're friendly with who are credible in whatever field it is, that community will take their opinion over the press, because everyone mistrusts the press to some extent. So that's really good. The second is, I can't believe that it took me until the PBS interview to learn the magic words of referring them to somebody else, because it was obvious after that H5N1 thing that everyone wanted to drill down to the same questions. They start out softballing and then they zoom in little by little on, well, what are your capabilities? Well, yeah, okay, you're not doing it, but what about another lab in your community? Well, what about another lab outside of this country? And I mean, it really got to the point of the PBS guy, because he was asking me about what was going on in Iran. And I just looked at him and I said, I'm not a biosecurity expert. This is a question for guys in law enforcement and Homeland Security. This is their job. Ask them what the percent chances of something like this happening. And I think that referring him to somebody like Nathan or the other people that are working in the field and just couching it as these are the professionals who have that knowledge and may be able to give you some sort of a number, whether or not you actually can, just to toss the ball to you is probably the most valuable lesson I learned from that interview. And I can't believe he actually put that up as part of the interview, was me tossing the ball to you, which was nice. Because it really got me off the hook, because what are you going to say? And controlling what you say is the third point. I think a lot of us, in anyone who has a science background, we feel that if we give an incomplete answer, it's a lie. And I've seen this in my former life in the biotech industry, people getting deposed in pharmaceutical lawsuits. And they'll invariably try to get some guy in middle management who doesn't have a lot of experience dealing with lawyers, and they love to depose them because they use techniques like insulting their credibility or their competence. They'll say things like, oh, so you don't know everything that was going on in your lab? Is that what a lab manager usually does? Or, you know, and so it's not necessary, and it's actually kind of damaging to give complete answers sometimes, because they can be twisted so much more easily. I mean, the honest answer in terms of bioterrorism is, yeah, there's probably somebody out there that's doing something bad. But if you say that, that's going to be your soundbite, you know? So, if you get too complete, and as you said, the level of understanding at the level of the Daily Mail or whatever is not going to be. So sometimes you have to just do what Asa did, and is repeat the phrase that you want. You see politicians do this all the time. Just repeat the message that you want to get across over and over again until they get tired of grilling you and they realize they're not going to get any further. And this was particularly funny because when PBS walked into Genspace, I got stuck in traffic. The only guy there was one of our brand new members, and they decided they would interview him. And he was completely unprepared, but what they didn't know was he was a lawyer. And he gave the best answers. He was terrific. They put some of his interview in there, but they started doing that drilling, and man, he wouldn't give an inch. They picked on the wrong guy. So just have that in mind also, kind of an almost an escape strategy. Is there someone else you can refer them to when they start getting really uncomfortable? The business of not representing the entire DIY bio and saying, well, this is what we do here. These are all really, really great ways, really great life rafts if you ever find yourself in that uncomfortable position of facing a camera. The other thing they did when they were interviewing Oliver and myself, which I don't know if it's a standard procedure, but they interviewed us, then they turned the camera around, they had the guy ask the same questions, they filmed him separately, and then they said, we want to film some reaction shots. Could you guys just like look at each other? So I'm thinking, you know, this guy is going to, the way it's going to be edited is, you know, so do you know anyone else in the community that's doing anything nefarious? Oliver and I look at each other. So that was also really uncomfortable. And it would be best if you think about it now before you're stammering in front of one of these guys.
Yeah, just on that point, I'd say that a reaction shot would be completely normal for a journalist to ask for. But if they're directing you in your reaction shot, that's weird. And you can say, you know, I'm not comfortable with doing that. you know, I'll you can ask me the question again, and I'll answer it from the reverse shot, because obviously he's only got one camera, which is why he's asking. But in terms of directing you to infer something else, and then non-verbally, then obviously...
Which, I mean, they were saying, look surprised, look smile, look at each other.
That's, you really shouldn't be doing that, that's awful. All you can say is just say, well, ask me the question again, and I'll answer it, and that's what they've got. But it's like putting words into your mouth, which they can't do, they shouldn't be doing.
This was public television.
Yeah, that's really unusual. Usually they'll have a shot of you, like, maybe walking towards the camera or away. But if they start staging things, there's a problem. And I think the other thing that people should realize is you actually control the interview. Like, you have to go in there going, hey, I know what I want to say. And if you want to read you an answer, just say, hey, can I say that again? There's no problems with saying, hey, can we stop and start over? Because a lot of times, if it's not live TV, you can always say, hey, you know what, that didn't come out right. Could we start that? Can you ask me that question again or rephrase that? Because I think that's another thing that people get intimidated by cameras. And honestly, like when we, with regard to the FBI, we get a lot of different heated questions about different issues. And it's not an issue with a reporter to just say, hey, can we do that question again? And that, you know, it's a professionalism thing with the reporter, and also just, you know, for you, if you feel like we need to redo an answer. So just always remember that you actually control the interview.
I would just like to say this theoretically, at least, it's I think a good thing that journalists ask questions and ask them many times and grill you, kind of, because we all want to have a press that asks fresh questions and puts up then answers that might be uncomfortable for the public, okay? So, or for the society or whatever. But that's most of the time just a theory, because most journalists nowadays don't have the time to really do this research and to check your quotes and stuff like that. They just come with an idea of an article. So the article is already laid out when they come to your to ask you. So, and they just want to have the right answers, and that's okay. Please say me in 20 seconds this and that. Okay. So and some journalists are actually doing this. So taking the time and talking with you, and then take the appropriate pieces from a two-hour interview. This is this just not possible, especially for the daily news or so. Not the newspaper, but in general, the daily news. I think in these early days of a new thing that comes up, I think the press is in a situation like the FBI was in the very beginning with Steve Kurtz and so on. So because they did a mistake. It was just only one mistake. I don't know about all the other cases, they were blank about what is this guy doing there. And the same situation is for a lot of journalists. So they come to you, they have no idea what you are doing. So, and they are asking all these questions. So, and they will learn with time, and perhaps they send the more experienced journalists with the topic within a few years or so. And so we get comfortable with that scene. And then we might leave this Kurtz phase of reporting. So,
I just wanted to say that different media have different roles. I think that you're luckiest when you get a magazine writer. I'm just saying that because that's what I'm writing. Because they're the ones who have the luxury of time. They're the ones who are going to spend 2 hours with you interviewing you. They're going to do repeated interviews. They're going to follow you around in your day, and hopefully they're going to write a nuanced piece. You know, if it's a newspaper article and they have a daily deadline, they need to get that thing out quickly. You know, the interview, if you're lucky, is, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and then they're off to the next thing. So yes, it's just a different ballgame. And then TV, which I know very little about, it sounds like, you know, they've already done the story before they get to you. They just need you as filler. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, in terms of the program, like it, it's the same thing for print media as well. If it's a news item on the day, you can have an idea of what the news program is, the news item is going to be about within the program, you know, and if it's going to be an hour long documentary about you, then it's you're going to have different thrust there, different levels of control. So again, it just depends kind of what the message is.
time for one more quick question, if there is one.
Yeah, sure. If you get asked an uncomfortable question in the course of an interview...
If you're asked an uncomfortable question in the course of an interview, and you, is it okay to just decline to answer? Does that look suspicious? You know, how do you kind of handle that?
I'll just answer quickly from my point of view. I think that preparation is key for any interview, and I think you should always think about what's the worst that they're going to ask me, and have prepared something in advance in your head, to read it out or anything. If it's... I can't think of an answer that would be unanswerable unless you have something to answer to. Is there anything other if there is an issue that you're uncomfortable with, then you probably might have to ask why you're uncomfortable with it. Otherwise, if you don't know the answer, that's a different thing, and then you can refer it. With the kind of the DIY biology ethos, with the whole community, with what you're doing individually, I can't see a situation where it will be difficult to do if you have already done your preparation for that interview. But it's always worth kind of going through with people beforehand, having a chat about it, maybe asking somebody to think of some really difficult questions for you, and then at least you can start formulating something if the kind of the question that you don't want to answer comes up, and you'll know what to say when it does.
Just to add to that, one strategy that really annoys us, but is actually quite effective, is just answer the question you want to answer. And inevitably, the conversation will go into another direction.
That's the advice I was given at TED. That's exactly what they said. They said they just, if you're asked a question where you don't want to answer it, or they want to sort of, I don't want to listen to words into your mouth, but if it's a topic that's getting out of your field of expertise, and you might paint yourself in a corner where you're like, oh my God, now I'm talking about upholstery, and I don't know anything about it, then you basically can just do what you just suggested, which is to say, well, I'm not really qualified to answer that, but what I can answer is, and you start going off into something you're talking about. I'm sure that'll drive you crazy, but nothing
you do at that point. Yeah, that's actually a great tip with redirecting. Just read the question and just swing it to what you want to talk about and what you know. And that's the thing about controlling an interview. You actually do have a lot of control. It's just a lot of it's practice, and a lot of it is narrowing, going, okay. Actually, FBI does this all the time. When we brief our executive managers when they have to do a press conference, we'll do a list of Q&As of like the hardest questions that a reporter probably has to ask about whatever it may be, whether it be like the Joint Terrorism Task Force or something like that. We'll do those Q&As, and we'll have a couple pages of it with answers to those questions or ways to redirect if we don't have an answer. And those are awesome tips.
So you said you have multiple pages of preparation, like how expensive is that?
It really depends. I mean, it's up to you on what you like, what the interview might be about. So it really depends on whatever topic it may be. Some things are more technical. Like it sounds like a lot of what you all do sounds more technical. So you might have to have more information on how to kind of explain something out. So it really depends. And you don't want to make it so overwhelming that you forget what's there. You want to keep it pretty simple so you can remember some of the questions and some of the answers to those questions. So don't make it like 10 pages. I try to keep things down to a couple of pages if possible.
Great. Well, we'll have Ben there. I apologize. Let's give a good...